this is, he's also really interesting. You have to say, because someone said, just down with the right, the guy. There's something to be said for that, right?
Yeah, there's a lot more than the last.
I think we should get started. I want to welcome you to what is, I guess, sadly the last of our year-long Sawyer seminars, a series of seminars that's devoted to trying to make sense of what's happening to inequality today, and to try to understand what's likely to happen on the inequality front in the future. The series is generously funded by the Mellon Foundation, hosted by the Center for the Study of Poverty and Inequality, which is a program within the Institute for the Research in the Social Sciences. It's also co-sponsored by the Stanford Center on Ethics and the Stanford Center on Philanthropy and Civil Society. And it's, as you know, it's our real honor and pleasure to have here today someone who's very famous, very eminent, and he's right there. And he is now, Chuck Zabel, he's now the professor of law and social science at Columbia Law School, formerly the Ford International Professor of Social Science at Columbia Law School, also a recipient, not bad, of the MacArthur Fellowship. His scholarship is profoundly influential and very wide-ranging. I think the Zabel that one knows is a function in part of one's age and one's discipline, and hence the particular Zabel book that was taking the world by storm at that moment of one's intellectual coming of age. And for me, that book was the Second Industrial Divide, a book that was very influential, not just, I think, within labor studies, but certainly within sociology and within all the social sciences. But for others, I suspect that the Zabel best known is not the Zabel of the Second Industrial Divide, but the Zabel of democratic experimentalism, and that would mean maybe that you're most familiar with a constitution of democratic experimentalism. And of course, there are a great many other Zabel books and articles that have been very influential and may define the Zabel that you know. So it's a real pleasure and honor to welcome him here today, an intellectual force of our time. So welcome.
Thank you. Thank you very much. That was very too kind, and it will be disavowed by the event. Let me just, why is this, okay. Let me just get back to being here. It's a pleasure to be here, and it's a pleasure indeed to see and get a chance to talk to a number of what's that category between a friend and a colleague when somebody has just been endeared by convergence of ideas and disputes too, and the passage of time. So it's just a pleasure to see a number of you and to have met some very active and inquiring people as well in the course of the day. What I'm going to do, because I took seriously the idea of trying to focus on inequality, is to bring together some parts of my work, some very current, or actually all in a way current, but some with longer roots than others, to try and say something about the prospects of the welfare state. It's a oddly, it seems just the idea of talking about the future of the welfare state and or its prospects and some of the categories to which I'm going to repair seems dated. It seems as though the very idea of a welfare state has become a little fugitive, at least in the United States. And so one purpose of this talk is to call to your attention a series of developments that should at least cause one to pause and question the idea that the very concept of a welfare state is no longer pertinent to our discussion. Now, what I want to do is take up two explanations for the limits of the welfare state. One of them, as you'll see in a second, as you can see reading ahead, is about fundamental limits, about the impossibility of welfare state. And that's a view that's common in the United States. The second view sees the current crisis of the welfare state and its travails in public debate as due to problems of adjustment. And these two views are, of course, mutually exclusive. I want to go through them. And as you'll see, speak against the first and in favor of the second, but in a way that is promising, I hope, but inconclusive. So here, the first view should be familiar, should be a reflex. It's just that the welfare state is impossible in the long term because it depends on high rates of taxation, and the high rates of taxation distort markets, particularly labor markets, they destroy the incentive to work, and so it's incompatible with market capitalism. And a second and related argument is about institutional capacity. It's that the bureaucracies, the public bureaucracies that determine eligibility and deliver services simply can't do this in a way which is effective given the complexity and variety of the situations they face and responsive to the rule of law values that we care about in a democracy. So that's a completely familiar view. And the second view is more, if you like, a European view, but you can find this in the work of Hacker and other American commentators as well. The second view is that the traditional system was based on insurance principles. There are changes in markets make risk so unpredictable that it becomes non-actuarial. You can't match payors to payees, so you can't insure against it. And then there's a straightforward alternative that gets invoked in a cynical way in American political discourse, as well as, of course, in social democracy in Europe, which is that what you need to do is to equip people, families, and individuals to respond to the risks they face themselves. Give them a set of capacities so that they can protect themselves, given those capacities by their own initiative in the turbulent markets against which whose outcomes they can't otherwise be protected. So this view says it's obvious what the solution is. It's hard to reach it because reaching it requires extensive reconfiguration of the sets of institutions that delivered insurance in an expansive sense in the old system. That's why we have adjustment problems. They're the problems of going from the insurance system to this system of service-based solidarity. They're different depending on the nation and the setting because path dependency or whatever you want to call habit and the inveterate responses, but they are transitional because the prospect of overcoming these problems creates persistent incentives to try and do so, and barring the political disasters that we know can happen to large democracies and in modern times, barring those kinds of disasters, we expect in time that the persistent incentive of achieving this result will lead to the solution of the problems. Now, there's an easy part and a hard part to what I want to present. The easy part is to present counterexamples to these the familiar objections, the sort of fundamental constraints objections. And I'm going to spend a little time showing you that the Nordic welfare states tax and spend on services. So it's, you know, taxing and spending, but it's a, you know, if you just hated taxing and spending, you may be a little more comfortable with the idea of taxing and spending on services, maybe not. But they tax and spend happily on services at high rates, and they do very, very well at on all labor market outcomes. They prosper on essentially every dimension that you can think of, and they do this while certainly not reducing in some cases, it's certainly not increasing in some cases, reducing already low rates of inequality measured by the usual kinds of measures. That's the first thing. So the Nordic welfare states are a counterexample, and we're going to see within the Nordic welfare states, there's a Danish model in particular, which actually links the good labor market outcomes to a very dramatic improvement. It becomes a kind of goad to productivity in a novel way. So it's not just that it produces equity, it's actually efficiency enhancing. And there's a bunch of evidence, though not statistical evidence for that. Second, we'll see that there's not a capacity problem, at least in the abstract. We're going to present in detail a type of organization, not a bureaucracy, but an organization that can deliver differentiated services of just the kind that you would need for this service-based solidarity. The illustration will be from child welfare in Utah and Alabama, where they do deliver such services. But the argument is that this is a very general class of institution, and I'll describe it. This is not about the organizational sociology of those institutions. I mean, that's another way of thinking about this is to describe what's novel about them as institutions. I'm interested here in just disestablishing just getting rid of your reflexive idea you can't have a welfare state because it depends on public bureaucracies that can't do the things that whatever kind of welfare state you're imagining would require being done. Now, the hard part is then putting these pieces together. Okay, you can show that you can tax and spend on services. You can show that you can deliver the services. There are institutions that can deliver the services. It would be very appealing to be able to present in one place a coherent model of these things together so we could actually exemplify the whole thing and we would understand how the pieces fit together. And for reasons that I'll say, we can't do that. We don't have the information, and it may well be that some of the institutions that deliver the services in places like Denmark are on the verge of being formalized, but in the way that I'm going to describe, but not yet. And I'll actually present some evidence in favor of that last view, but it's inconclusive. I mean, we have a macro outcome, the Nordic welfare state outcome, without an absolutely ironclad account of the mechanisms that produce it, and we have a set of mechanisms which I'd like to think we can, with some confidence, characterize as having the capacities we need, but we can't demonstrate their macro outcomes. We can't actually demonstrate a whole lot about their long-term outcomes. We can't say, for example, though I won't go into this, we can't say kids that have gone through this system, child welfare system, do better 10 years later than kids that went through an equivalent system, you know, or a system with traditional defects, even though at the time they exited, they appeared to be, those in the first system appeared to be better. So we can't quite match that up. Okay, so here, with that caveat, which is hopefully, though not small, totally disabling, let me just try and shift your priors a little bit about what a welfare state can be. That would be okay, just to do that. And then maybe you'll come away also with a picture of a concrete thing that a welfare state could be given the enlarged constraints. So this is familiar. Welfare states clump into families. Just Esping Anderson wrote terrific things about this. Nobody does anything but use it. It's just taken as a fact of natural life in the world of people who look at welfare states. There are the Nordic ones, the sort of folk home universal benefits, ones that provide a lot of their benefits in the form of services, social services typically, you know, sort of child care and various forms of continuing training and the like. There are the Bismarckian ones, not surprisingly named after Bismarck, and found in Bismarck in continental Europe, where the benefits are tied to labor market history, work experience, and generally, though in recent years not so much, generally that experience is registered through participation in a trade union or some other kind of professional association. And then there's the Anglo-American welfare state that we know from all too well, and you can decide for yourself whether it's a welfare state or an effort not to have you, whatever, you know, it's a liminal case in all of these things. So we don't need, it turns out not to be, in this story, it turns out not to be, it's an outlier, it turns out not to be very important. So the quick story is this: if you really want to feel right about not having loved the welfare state, you can look at the Bismarckian welfare state, and you can revel in the rightness of your doubts. They really don't do very well, and Russell Sage has a very large project on low-wage work, and the two countries, they measure low wages in a bunch of ways, you know, sort of less than two-thirds of the average wage, or, you know, standard deviations from the median, so on. The two countries that come out worse, that have the largest share of low-wage workers, are roughly 25%, depending on the measure, the United States and Germany. So Germany has really done a bad job with the, this is not what, things you hear about the difficulties of the Bismarckian welfare state are not wrong. The two countries that come out best are France and Denmark. France does it entirely through a redistribution internal to the labor market, and Denmark does it through a system that I'll describe. The Anglo-American system, not going to surprise anyone. We grow well, but we treat the unfortunate among us really pretty badly. And the Nordic one does well on both. I don't know if you can read this. This is the public sector outlays. Total public sector outlays, English speaking, this is as a share of GDP. You can see 17.4% for the English speaking, Nordic 25, Europe 26, Nordic 26, and the United States 14. So this is there are really big differences in the share of GDP that flows through the government. These are not small numbers. Okay.
Europe is continental Europe.
Yeah. Yeah. These are
excluding the Nordic.
Yes, exactly. It's the Bismarckian. I'm sorry. This is all from these tables. Sorry about that. It was in the paper. I didn't put it on the slide. Jeff Sachs. There was a little. I came upon this on the web. There was a little congress of people who were worrying about why Europe was doing so badly. Philippe Aguillon. There are a bunch of interesting papers about why Europe was tanking. And Jeff Sachs, for reasons I don't quite know, he produced a paper. Well, you know, I just did some. This is not the story. And these are numbers that from this little paper of his. But the sources are public. He ran a couple of regressions in. Here are the inequality and poverty measures, and it's interesting. You notice here, by the way, I didn't call it to sufficient attention to this. Direct provision of services is much higher in the Nordic states than in, it's 3.5 percentage points higher in the Nordic states than in continental Europe, and you know, much, these, very, very big differences. And I didn't do this for you, but if you break this down into labor market service, there are huge differences. There's a lot of money, a lot of percentage points of GDP being spent in these countries on services and active labor, different kinds of labor market services in particular. So here are the outcomes. The poverty rate, and I think the poverty rate here is just share of the population below half the average income. But you look at the lowest quintile and the Gini coefficients, and it's all the same story. And again, those are big differences. And this is not, you just to make sure you get the picture, it's not that this is achieved by excluding people from the labor market. The employment rates are higher, or as high. They're way higher in the Nordic countries, in the continentals, and as high essentially as in the U.S. If you look at the numbers in detail in Denmark, there it's they. I'll say more about that in a second. A category of the Nordic countries is the Danish flexicurity model. They're actually quite different. The industrial structures are very different. Finland has very big firms. Denmark has lots of small and medium-sized firms. They're despite being Nordic countries, they're quite different on a number of dimensions. And when you start looking through these numbers, it's salient. So let me describe the system, which is the best characterized system, the one with the best outcomes, the one that links the labor market outcomes and the general achievement of equity to economic dynamism, and does it in a way that points us in the direction of the importance of but not only service provision, but service provision of a certain kind and by certain methods. So here's the... it's called flexicurity because people who do policy are, not full of linguistic fantasy. So, you feel free, write in, but you go to a French bookstore and, there's all these books about flexicurity. So, and they don't actually say much more than this for reasons that I'll get to. But everybody in Europe, in tired old Europe, knows about this. Who's interested in these things at all, knows about this Danish model. It has three features. First, the flexible labor market. And as you'll see in a second, it's really flexible. Denmark had a craft economy, and in the late 19th century and through the 1890s, the craft workers were highly organized, and they essentially beat the employers at a bunch of strike, lockout, wars or games, and the result was a lot of wage inflation. One sector would strike and the next sector would strike, and the employers responded with a massive lockout, and there was a deal. And the deal was centralized wage bargaining in return for recognition of the right of unions to organize and also a union checkoff. Unions could collect money from workers' wages with management participation, and an explicit recognition of the right of employers to fire workers with, not without cause, but for economic reasons. So this was established. There were actually disputes of this kind later on in the continental countries, but one of the first and clearest outcomes of this was an explicit agreement of this kind. So this was not neoliberal. This was at the beginning of the what became neo-corporatism in Denmark. It was the there was a very explicit trade. Second, also something of long date, though it goes back, kind of reformulated various points, and and reaches its apogee in the sort of 60s, and then continues. Very, very generous support for people who lose their jobs. The replacement rate, net of taxes, so the taxes are very high, so the net replacement rate it differs substantially according to level of income, and 80% is the median replacement rate, rising to 90% and more, 90% for low-wage workers, and even more for single mothers. And the third thing is this active labor market policy, which has two functions. One is to make sure that if you get the benefit, you look for work. But two, if you look for work, you are provided with services that will make your search successful and effective in the sense that you acquire skills that allow you to be choosy about for whom you work. Okay, I'm not sure that was an explicit intent, but it was certainly an outcome. Now, there were a bunch of reforms in 1993-94 at the end of a severe economic crisis in Denmark that actually created the institutional preconditions for providing these services. So the first thing is that they were individualized. Everybody who's out of work gets a plan, gets an actual plan that tells them what services they're going to get and where they can look for work, and then people update the plan. And we're going to see that plays a role again in some of the institutions we're going to look at in more detail. And then the second is radical decentralization of the to the regional level. And the crucial point here is it's quite explicit in the law that the you rebuild the programs, you modify the programs to serve people's needs. The goal is not to figure out which people are eligible for existing, to apply the eligibility requirements for existing programs potentially eligible population. The goal is to adjust the services to the needs of people who will be looking for work. And then there's a series of leaves which make it much easier for people to take time off from work or from family responsibilities to take advantage of these services. Okay, so the overall effect of all this is that they really get a lot of services. They really get a lot of services. In the paper, I just report something that's relevant here, what the take-up rate of services among low-skilled workers, so continuing education for people who are most at risk in the labor market, shoots up, so that 30% of Danish low-wage workers are getting further training that ups their skills compared to 14% in the U.S. And if you look at some of these numbers, the share of workers that have gotten training in the last 5 weeks, it's clear there's just a massive amount of training being thrown at people. I don't go through the all the numbers here. Well, let me just give you a sense of how the labor market works, and then tell you something about the economic outcomes. So this is job changers as a fraction of the unemployed. The green bar is Denmark. That's the number of 22 or 23% of people change jobs every year. Okay, the only countries that are higher are Spain and Iceland. And Spain at this point, this is 1998, the report from which it's taken is quite recent, but the number, there's complexity with some of these numbers and the series. There are breaks in the series so that it's not possible to give them the sort of very recent things. But Spain in this period has got a savagely informal labor market, and Iceland has systems more like Denmark. That's a lot of job changing. And of course, there's job, net job creation. So you're getting basically 30% of you know, in the current period, you're up to about 30% of people changing jobs every year. And that is reflected in a correspondingly low tenure of employed workers. So Iceland again, and then the U.S., and then Denmark. So for, you know, a little under 8 years. And nonetheless, this is sort of useful. I just, you know, just so you get a sense of this, if you ask people how concerned are you, in what degree, if at all, are you worried about losing your current job? The Danes are and there's a scale. Sorry, the least worried are after the Norwegians or the Danes. So tremendous. They have to rate this on as, you know, the less worried you are, the higher you are on the scale, and so the Danes turn out to have, you know, this is a little counterintuitive. 30% of the people, you have no job protection. Your 30% of the people are actually shifting jobs every year, and nobody's worrying about job security. There's a part of this where there's no charts and graphs for it, but there are a whole bunch of studies of the actual operation of Danish firms and the Danish labor market. And what you see is that the massive accumulation of skill at all levels means that now you're down to unemployment rates that are around 2%. Okay, we're at 1993, 94, we're at 12.5%. 1998, we're at 5.2. Now we're, you know, really low. You're getting competition for skilled workers, and that means, of course, that the firms have to move into high value-added work where they can use the skills. They're getting priced out of these. They move into sophisticated niche markets instead of more mass markets, as you might expect. But this means that the competition for workers becomes an additional productivity whip, or a strategic baffle that's guiding firms in the direction of higher skill outcomes. Now it's a partial system because when you look around, and for reasons I won't explain, I've actually spent a bunch of time looking for this, and it's not, I'm stubborn. I went looking for this in the early 90s and didn't find anything like it, so I know when it's not there. And I wasn't expecting this, but I did. This is my second go at this. You can't really find good accounts of how the labor market institutions work. What happens is there's a lot of it's at the local level. There's informal, you know, there are a lot of people who know a lot, and, you know, social networks that coalesce around these people, and, you know, they use the resources of the law. But the institutions are semi-formal. I mean, there's a lot of, as you would expect, or might expect. A good test of what the Danes do and don't know about this system is that they try and apply the same principles. They see that differentiated services are the right thing. They really work in the labor market. So they try and apply that to their school system. Because their school system, unlike their vocational training system, is rotten. And they would like to fix it by applying the same methods. Here's their school system. These are PISA scores from 2003, is that right? Doesn't say, it's 2003. And you can see Denmark is second from the bottom. The blue line are the boys. We're below the OECD average. Denmark spends every year, depending on the year, between the first and second, it's first and second in the league tables of spending per pupil in the world. And a finer-grained analysis of this amount shows that about a third of the Danish boys leave school as functional illiterates. So not a springboard for the learning society. Okay? Now, this is not a new problem. The Danes, it turns out, have known about this, different forms, you know, the different test results and different, since the early 90s. And they started to create, this just, you'll notice, in the early 90s, they reform the labor market institutions, and they create these eleupleina they want to do the same thing for students. So, you know, you're having trouble, and the teacher figures out sort of where the difficulties are and what the remedial bundle of services, very similar to the sorts of reforms that are now spreading very rapidly through American schools. The question is how you do this, how you figure out, how you make the determination, how you transmit the information, how you provide the services, check that it's right. It's easy to say, it's, you know, as usual in these things, it's hard to do. The law, the 2006, they come back to this in a very emphatic way in an amendment of the school law, and they really start to insist on it. And a report from December 2007 says they're still screwing up, not having much effect. But it discovers that the Swedes are doing very well at doing this. So people there, and I expect that when I go back now, I'll find, you know, they're starting to go look carefully and see who is doing it and who's not doing it and what the problems are. And so there, it seems like they're not that far from its. You know, they're not far from being able to do it, but they're not able to do it yet. So it's, in that sense, they plainly don't have a good grip on the micro mechanisms that are the foundation of this stuff. And by the way, even if they did have a characterization of it, we'd still have to know more because you couldn't just copy, right? This is the familiar problem of transporting institutions from one country to another. It's like the problem of transporting them from one sector of a country to a different sector of that same country. You need to contextualize it, obviously. Okay, now we come to, that's the first counterexample, right? So we have the Nordic countries and flexicurity. That tells us you can tax, provide services and get good outcomes. Now, what about the idea that you can, there are going to be capacity constraints. You might say, look, the Danes can do this. They can barely do it. You know, it's like buoyancy in one bathtub. You know, they've got the principles of buoyancy for one bathtub, but not for the sink. So, you know, that's something, but doesn't seem like the whole picture. And you might say they can only do it because there's some endowment of culture and institutions that allows them to do this in one sector and not others. So there's no, it's not really it's a demonstration that you don't necessarily subvert incentives to work, but not a demonstration that we have the institutional capacity to provide these services, okay? And we have a bunch of reasons for thinking that we're never gonna have them, we can't have them, and those reasons in the United States in academic circles go under the heading of street-level bureaucracy. This is a hoary term. It comes from a book in 1980 by Michael Lipsky. Scholar Googled it to see whether it, you know, it's still in use, and you know it lives on. These things propagate themselves, and I'll say something about that in a second. It's an important idea. So here's what it is. It's you don't need to read this because you've intuited this. You're socialized to believe this, a lot of this already. Street-level bureaucrats are people who interact directly with citizens and have substantial discretion in the exercise in their work. So that's, you know, police and teachers and social workers and the paradox here is that the whole aim of bureaucracies were invented so that the people at the top, the king and the minister and the captain of industry and the head of the administration can enlist and subordinates in the execution of their purposes, effectively enlist them. That's why bureaucracies are created. And now in street-level bureaucracies, we have the agents, in effect, determining policy in the small for individuals they interact with, and in the large for the aggregate of the people that they encounter, in lieu of the principle. So it's what the agents do that determines the actual policy, and there's been, how do we explain this inversion of and this is, it's pretty straightforward. As in a real bureaucracy, always with scare quotes around the real or bureaucracy, whatever, in a real bureaucracy, the goals are set at the top. But in street-level bureaucracies, even more, one would have to say, or especially, as in contrast to, the other kind of bureaucracies, the more normal ones, the goals are ambiguous and contradictory. So this is, familiar. The police prevent disorder, maintain order, but they have to do that by the rule of law, respecting all these, in child welfare, you have to further the best interests of the child, you have to preserve families, but you have to, whenever possible, but you have to protect children from any serious risk of harm. Teachers have to prepare people for the workforce, but they have to make them, train them to be, empower them to be citizens of democracy and to flourish as individuals, and so on and so forth. And so, given these ambiguities and tensions in the definition of the goals, any effort to render them as a set of operational instructions produces, too few rules, because you don't want to constrain, you know you're going to fail to write the rules that will cover the situation, so you omit that. You have very general standards, principles, and then the absence of rules invites the exercise of discretion, or you write a zillion rules. And then the agent is free at her, for reasons of her own, to decide which of those rules to enforce. There's a terrific study by Braithwaite and Braithwaite, Mr. and Mrs. Braithwaite, about rating nursing home agencies in the United States and Australia. In Australia, they have very few principles, but they have to discuss things. In the United States, they have hundreds of very exact rules, and they just check the inter-rater reliability. In the United States, it's zero, because everyone rates according to their specialty. The nurses see the nursing problem, and somebody decides if they think of the nursing home is misbehaving, they cite them for a past infraction, which is especially onerous, and if they think they're trying their best, they cite them for a related but different infraction, so that doesn't matter. So they have absolute total discretion despite the endless profusion of rules. And in Australia, because they actually have to talk with each other and the residents of the home, the inter-rater reliability turns out to be extraordinarily high. So, and we'll come back to that, but it's just a very good, it's a kind of fantastic example of what happens when you do try and cabin these things by rules. So then the third thing, of course, is that the outcomes are supposed to be unobservable. You just have no idea what is actually going on. So there's no, not only is there discretion, but the discretion can't be checked because no one saw the outcome. So you get to pick, as the agent, you get to pick the rule that you like or interpret the principle in the way you prefer, and nobody can second guess you or hold you accountable. And this is from this terrific book by James Q. Wilson. I went back and I was not trying to be bad to police officers. That's a variety of police behavior. This is how he characterizes. And I, just to get it on the slide, I took some stuff out, but this is what people thought you were really flying blind. This is just the condition, the natural condition of bureaucracy. Now, there are two reactions to this characterization of, two legitimate reactions to this characterization of of street-level bureaucracy. The first is, yeah, that's it. We don't have a systematic alternative. If you ask someone, you know, like, what else is there? What other form of public service delivery is there? I'm omitting here, a kind of long discussion about what, privatization and new public management and all the things which are meant to mitigate the defects of street-level bureaucracy. But, long story short, if you ask people what is there, there's basically street-level bureaucracy and then a bunch of hand-waving and efforts, costly efforts to try and mitigate it, costly in the sense that you lose a lot in the effort to gain an indeterminate amount of control over your agents. And the second reaction is, this looks like it's from a different world. You read that list and you know something about the way modern public service organizations function, it just doesn't look right. In fact, all organizations, I don't know how many, if you've read Moneyball, this doesn't look like a baseball loving crowd. What?
Not from Boston.
So I don't know, maybe. It's about Oakland. It's about Oakland, and I thought maybe Michael Lewis. It's a business book. Anyway, Moneyball is a fantastic account of what was wrong with the baseball statistics that James Q. Wilson was saying. Where those are, we can really rely on those. People relied on errors. They thought errors were important. Defense is a low variance activity. Errors are just somebody's subjective guess about what should have happened. No information there. On, kind of walks, very valuable because they increase the chances of good things happening in the inning in which you drew the walk, people not paying attention. Turned out you could buy players who could produce, avoid bad outcomes and produce great outcomes, contribute fractional inputs to great outcomes for nothing compared to the price of people who looked like fantastic athletes. So there was hope for some of us getting hired by virtue of some of our contributory hidden, non otherwise features unobservable except statistically. Hope on. There's a bunch of I won't go through all this, but if you know about business metrics, the idea that there are single metrics is just wrong. You need a bunch of different kinds of metrics, and the main point about having a bunch of different kinds of metrics is that having many requires you to continuously discuss which kinds of metrics are relevant. So business outcomes, the seeking profitability, supposing you think that's the goal, which let's assume it is the goal, turns out to be a very high dimensional activity. You need lots of metrics. It's not that the public sector has high dimensional goals and the business world has low dimensional goals. They're both high dimensional in different ways, and you need a bunch of metrics for it. And finally, there's an explosion of some horrific and some really useful performance measures in the public sector as well. Okay, you can find out a huge amount about where kids are. If you have the right kinds of tests, you can find out not only how kids are performing in math at a particular level, but where their chain of reasoning breaks down and whether particular remedial measures are effective. And people use those things routinely. The idea that outcomes are unobservable, that there's an unbridgeable gap between the public and the private sector, that doesn't look right, doesn't feel right to anybody who has experience of these kinds of things today. And the idea that public sector institutions can't know anything about their outcomes, that doesn't look right either. Now, I'm going to go quickly. I'm going to, because here something is where the deus ex machina is about to descend. We're going to wheel in the new style organization. This is the point here. The point of introducing this is to give you a sense of a systematic sense of what kind of organization could deliver the kinds of differentiated services that you would need if you were going to try and get the Danish style outcomes, assuming that there's not confounding variable, that they're actually caused by the investment of services that we see, the investment of labor market services. We have a bunch of things that point us right to the existence of a bunch of institutions, and then things get lost in the woods of informality. And now the question is, if we're going to do this, if we're going to build them, what kind of institutions do we want? And as I said, I'm not going to spend a lot of time characterizing them from the point of view of contrasting them with hierarchies. I just want to give you a quick sense of the things they do, how they work, and tell you that they do work. This is what happens in Utah. About more than 30 states are under injunction because their child welfare agencies produce, I guess the kindest thing you could say about them is that they produce unconstitutional outcomes. That would be the nicest thing. Courts ordered them to reform, and for decades, the reforms consisted largely in imposing large sets of rules on them, exactly what you might expect given your idea that these were street-level bureaucracies that had gone out of hand. You impose a bunch of rules. It turns out to be really hard to write and enforce those rules. You don't get much reform. Eventually, people start experimenting with different kinds of solutions, and what they do is they come up with this model, and here are the features. So the idea is you don't say we're going to eliminate frontline discretion. You acknowledge that there has to be frontline discrimination. And you say you're going to exercise it by making plans for kids. It's this idea of individualized planning again. And you're going to be held accountable for the plans you make because you're going to have to explain the choices that you make in the planning and the provision of services to your peers and your and the review of these explanations is a way not only of correcting individual mistakes, but it's a way of learning about flaws in the routines of the organization or even in ambiguities or mistakes in the goals that the organization set itself. So there's if you can figure out a systematic way of reviewing these things, you can learn. There's a lot of learning at different scales. So So here are the key elements in the thing, and attribution. The Danish work is a joint project with Per Hul Christensen, and this work is based on taken directly from. An ongoing project with my colleague, your former friend and colleague, or your current friend and former colleague, Bill Simon. Here are the elements in this system. There's, as in that Danish labor market model, customization, and you get case plans. That's the first thing. The second thing is that if we flip back, you would see that the definitions of street-level bureaucracy assume that people are operating as individuals. In this model, they're most emphatically not operating as individuals. They form teams that involve other professionals, you know, the sort of the psychiatrist and the school counselor and maybe the mom's drug therapy person and maybe somebody from the prison, if that's necessary, but you get an interdisciplinary team. It involves the kid and the family as well, and sometimes you get teams that are chaired by the kids that they are, and the kids that they are in, whose interests they've been operating, and you get this diagnostic monitoring. So the core, I just want to keep this compressed so we can have time for discussion. The core element of this, the thing that formalizes, that turns it into a system for generating an institution. I guess that's the key point here is the innovation that makes this something different from an effort to change the culture of the organization by training people in a certain way or having them operate in teams. The thing that actually generates a systematic review of the operating routines is this called a quality service review. And the way it actually works is that two people are paired, somebody from inside the agency, often somebody from outside or from another district, and they go and they review all the background material for an individual case. They talk with the kid and all the people involved in the team. They see all the email traffic. And they look to see whether they make judgments about whether the plan was appropriate, whether the information necessary to make the plan was gathered in what seems like the appropriate way, whether the plan was revised in the light of new information, the composition of the team changed, whether the services were reviewed, and so you can see whether or not the caseworker has managed this process in a way which is a plausible, a compelling interpretation of the general principles of the agency, and mobilizes the resources required to do that, or alerts others that that's not happening. So, I won't go into, if somebody asks, I can explain more about the details of the actual review. But it's a review that occurs at several levels, because first the case is reviewed, then the people discuss their evaluations of the individual cases with each other. So the reviewers of each case criticize comment on the reviews of the other cases, and finally there's a joint session where everybody talks about the joint results and tries to extract, to understand to the extent possible, whether or not there are general problems in the way the institution is operating or in its interpretations of its principles. Okay, so two. There is no conclusion. I one of these exams where you just shout time at the end. I would just there's no. But I there are some there are some ideas. My intent at a minimum was to alert you to some developments in areas that seem brackish, to let you know that the welfare state, or in one of its families, is doing something which is counter-theoretic. It's thriving under conditions that it shouldn't, by our theories, and it seems to be operating despite our expectations of unrebuttable presumptions against constraints on its success in two forms. That on the one hand, the state can intervene massively in the economy if it purchases the right kinds of and provides the right kinds of services. And second, somehow, it seems to be possible, at least in some cases, to provide those services routinely under circumstances that suggest that it's possible to organize that provision even more. And we have the Utah example to suggest a class of organization that can build these things. Now, one kind of conclusion is that would be to note that a lot of the features that make the Utah kind of institution self-correcting are also features that would allow you to build it, should make it easy to construct in the first place. That is, you're talking about incremental change, small improvements, a capacity to detect mistakes. So you don't have to get it right. You just have to start the process. There's something reassuring about that. And to the extent that that's true, and then people get better at understanding how to build these kinds of institutions in different settings, we may see that the Nordic-style welfare state becomes available as a more complete and compelling model. And the second thing is a thought prompted by a suggestion by Josh Cohn, which I think is, as often with his suggestions, nearly invariably worth pursuing. Suppose this is all right. Supposing it really turns out to be true that you can construct, we can move from insurance-based solidarity to some kind of service-based solidarity, and that we can do that in a way which not only doesn't cause a penalty, doesn't require us to pay a penalty in growth, but may actually be growth growth enhancing. Supposing that's close to right and that we can build the necessary institutions and that it turns out to be the very things that make them good at delivering services make them easy to build. That would be terrific. What kind of a polity would we be building? And here Josh called my attention to this very interesting, trenchant and in a quiet way, impassioned discussion by Rawls in the restatement of justice as fairness. So a very, very late, unfinished work. And it's a harsh criticism of welfare capitalism for allowing vast accumulations of power and essentially for purchasing social tranquility at the price of a violation of the fair conditions of political participation. There are a bunch of other criticisms as well, but surprisingly, since you might have thought of Rawls as the supreme apologist of the social democratic redistributionist state with the difference principle as the center of that, it's interesting and to see that he actually very clearly sees a limit to redistribution as a matter of political sociology. And he's very attentive in this to the sociological implications for the construction of a polity of different forms of reducing inequality. And he sees it as a disaster on that account. And by the way, to recall the strike of 1899, many social democrats of the day were opposed to those sorts of compromises precisely because they thought that in sacrificing skill, they would be creating a form of political dependency. They saw skill as a kind of, as the equivalent of 40 acres and a mule, and the guarantee of yeoman autonomy, and they foresaw, in some measure correctly, you might say, dependency, that this was there was some porridge being purchased at a high price. So there's on the big assumption that this that the rest of this is as suggested, there's a possibly appealing conclusion that it could be that in producing the skill, the master skills necessary for service-based solidarity, you're actually producing a redistribution of assets that enhances the autonomy of individuals, even while it opens possibilities for political participation, because they are, by definition, the co-producers of their own human capital. Now, what would that mean, and what would it mean for understanding of democracy? At a minimum, it relieves a problem in the familiar ideas of asset-based yeoman democracy, which is that they argue that we need to avoid dependence on redistribution by shifting to asset-based forms of autonomy. But of course, it takes a massive redistribution of assets to give people the assets they need for that autonomy. But here's a way they can have those assets, acquire those assets incrementally and in a way that enhances various forms of participation and accountability. An afterthought to a disjointed presentation. Thank you for your patience. I hope your priors are disturbed. Thank you.
So this sounds like a great model for providing services in a welfare state or some other form of state. And so the puzzle is that you don't see it happen very much. So I'm trying to think about why that is. Now, one possibility is that it costs organizations more to do this. You said some things that imply that maybe it doesn't cost more, but so that's the question. Would it cost organizations more to do this? And if it doesn't cost organizations more to do things this way, then what prevents this from happening? Is it just that people don't see that this is the right way to do it, and as soon as they see it, they can do it, or is it harder than that?
Well, that's the key question. That's why I think it's easy to sort of cast doubt on the constraints view, but hard to really present an overwhelming, a really compelling case for the adjustments view has that implication that this is all just a matter of time and that people will do it. Now, you know, in historical time, this is short adjustment periods. If you think this is, for example, the equivalent of 1850, imagine this is mass democracy and it's 1855. And, you know, there's been the American Revolution, but we're heading, you can see the Americans are heading towards a civil war and a French Revolution, and that ended badly for democracy. And then there was this frittering away of stuff in 1848. And, you know, where's this going? And, you know, J.S. Mill, you've got people, you know, Tocqueville and J.S. Mill, and just people are saying, oh, you know, and so on. But where's this, like, beef here? You know, so, I mean, maybe we're in a situation like that. This is the Nordic. supposing we look at it from the point of view, say why are the Nordic countries discovering it? Well, they all went through Norway accepted because of hydrocarbons. They went through massive economic dislocations. Denmark almost went bankrupt in the 80s because of its traditional welfare state. And Finland almost went bankrupt in the early 90s because of the loss of the Russian market, but also rigidities in its economy. And Sweden really tanked in the 80s so that its per capita GDP was like at Spanish levels. So, and occasionally below Spanish levels. So these were very severe dislocations. And in the midst of this, they discovered that the impact of a percent increase in unemployment on their fiscal stability and growth was way higher because of the way all of these they had built in the stabilizing mechanisms meant that the cost of unemployment was enormous and the cost of the gain from reducing unemployment was consequently also very large. So they had gotten themselves into the situation where there was no cushion and they were at very high risk because of these automatic mechanisms of really going bankrupt if they didn't find a way of addressing the unemployment problem. So all of them went through a series of forced draft reforms and they've done much better. Now you can say, historical accident, or you can say, look, this is, you know, in any place, somebody is going to be first. There are reasons why the incentive structure favored a greater concentration of the mind on this issue in the Nordic countries than elsewhere. And conversely, you can say, if you look at the continental countries, you can see why the accident of the Bismarckian system made it really, it was the exact opposite. There, you had job benefits and unemployment benefits tied to the maintenance of your existing workplace. So you were building in huge labor market rigidity because the only way you could get social welfare benefits was by staying in your, essentially tied to your current workplace. So you had that, plus you had institutions committed to that, or that were administering these programs with a semi-constitutional voice in government. So you can see why one group was really obstructed, another group highly motivated, and in the U.S. there were a lot of other things going on, a big jumble. So you can give an account. I want to say two things. One is you're absolutely right. That's the test. These things are always hard. I'll give you one more example: the spread of lean production or the equivalent. You know, there is no one who doubts. Sector by sector, that this is, you know, these, let's call them Toyota production methods. There's no question they are diffusing sector by sector. If you go into a particular plant, it's not uncommon to see one production line working that way, and to the left and the right lines that don't work that way. And you think you have your question. What is it in... How can it be that you have before you the example of the returns to doing this and you tolerate for an hour these other things? And the answer turns out to be very simple. There are only so many people that can do this. There are only, the costs of adjustment are high. The gains are high and the costs of adjustment are high. Now, I think that makes for a precarious situation. I think it would be completely fatuous, and I've tried to avoid, that's part of the reason I set this up this way, is this is about possibilities, not about, it's not the full the full frontal functionalist argument that, you know, affects cause causes. I actually said words to that effect, that because that is what the adjustments view suggests in the end. We'll see. But it's that's what to watch. You know, if people, one last point. Sorry, this is that's part of the reason that I find this Swedish. Per Hol and I are writing a book for the Danish debate about this very problem in Denmark, because Denmark seems to be on the edge of either being fully explicit about this and institutionalizing in a large scale, or actually destroying it, because there are, you know, there are people in the government who have a completely different view of what's going on. So there's a big fight about this. We'll see. Sorry. Both of you.
Okay, so, I don't believe this, so I wasn't even that disturbed. So why? One, it seems to me that having a system would require one of two things, either very high, considerable skill in the service providers, much more so than the person who's just checking off stuff on the list. Or if you don't have considerable skills, this kind of system in which you have groups discussing cases in which there's some kind of, you know, peer review, you know, and it's more than just peer review, but wouldn't that be extremely expensive? You know, this is falling back on, oh my God, every, you know, welfare worker has 50 cases now. You know, what would happen if you needed five people to discuss every case? So it's hard to see how this is working without a, without higher skill sets or more money compared to, say, where we are in the U.S. now, if you thought about heavy adjustment.
Well, I mean,
maybe that's wrong.
Well, you know, well, there's something to it. I can't on the one hand say, look, adjustment is not automatic because it has high costs, and then say, oh, well, you just mentioned some costs, they're obviously irrelevant. I mean, I totally agree. Here are some considerations. We looked at Utah just because, just to eyeball the situation. The people in the Utah system are not, they don't have fancy degrees, they have low wages, they don't seem to be distinguishable on any, you have actually the opposite situation, which is there's an incredible cost to having these rule-driven systems, which is that there are people who go into these professions because they actually care. They care about, you know, I mean, it's not just, you know, it's a job, but it's not just a job. They actually care, and they are immensely frustrated when all they can do is check a box. And where one, this is, I'm not making this up, a box can be, is the child in at a high risk of abuse? Yes, no, not sure. You can check not sure. You could check not sure in New Jersey, and that was an acceptable outcome. So, you know, sort of that, and people walk away from those. It's gut wrenching. Now, does it cost more to actually run the system? It probably does, but it's not clear how much more. I did a very crude. I looked at the revenues on the expenditures on child welfare normalized for caseload by state income, by, you know, kind of median income per state, and there's no connection. It's a sort of, there are a lot of rich states that spend, you know, ridiculously little on child welfare, and a lot of poor states that spend a lot. It's complete, and there's a lot of resources wasted. I guess an additional consideration is that Michael Wald brought up is, imagine something which is the case, that a bunch of other organizations, like schools and like the police, and other social welfare providers are moving towards casework of this same kind. So that now when you start having these teams, you're drawing on people who are already being in part, so you're spreading the training costs over a wider variety of institutions. It may be that things that used to be, that are now part of the child welfare system would be detected and dealt with by these other ones. So completely possible. As with a lot of these institutions, they're so inefficient right now that nobody has an idea of the true cost of reform. That's one point. And the second point is I think that if the Danish example and the Nordic example show nothing else, it's that they do show that people are willing to pay a lot for services that work. There is no, in the recent Danish election, the competition between the neoliberal side and the social democratic side was who could do a better job of making the welfare state work, improve the working of the welfare state. The neoliberal party and its allied parties started out as tax reduction parties, and they have become welfare state reform parties. So there is, without minimizing the potential cost, there are some ways of amortizing. There's our usual friend, fraud, waste, and abuse, where we can magically save the day. And there is the consideration that people will pay more for services that really work if they see these virtuous circles.
Yeah, I want to follow up yet again, I guess, on the question of viability, but not with respect to the costs, but whether or not one can imagine these sort of highly customized organizational forms persisting over the long haul, or might they instead be transformed into more standardized arrangements in the long haul? And what occurred to me in this regard is the old experiment at UC Santa Cruz with trying to develop these more customized relationships between students and teachers. One aspect of that being that you shouldn't give just straight grades, but give these highly tailored individualized assessments of your performance. And the urban legend, at least, I don't really know where the truth lies, the urban legend was, in the end, you know, the professor confronted with hundreds and hundreds of students would have the A paragraph, the B paragraph, the C paragraph, and the D paragraph, and you just kind of transform what was supposed to be a customized relationship into a very standardized, routinized process. And I'm wondering if that same sort of outcome might be a plausible one with respect to the type of organizations you described. That is, if you're confronted with large numbers of cases that you have to deal with and process, you begin to transform what might once have been kind of a customized approach into a very standardized one. And maybe that's a good type of standardization because it's kind of a bottom-up standardization in which it's the right type of standardization. But in any way, I thought maybe you could weigh in on how you think these organizational forms might evolve over time and whether or not standardization is a likely outcome and a good one.
Well, I think you anticipated the answer. It sounds like it's true that I have a Pollyanna side. I'm not, you know, I really understand what the limits of, you know, the evidence are, and institutions. You don't have to believe in classical political theory to know that there can be cycles in the life. You know, over long periods of time, institutions can get routinized. But I do think that the point you made that you have to differentiate between stagnation and useful routinization of subtasks. That is, you know, kind of if you get good at forming teams, you get good routines for forming teams, that's like consciousness itself. You know, the kind of cognitive science view of consciousness is we automate a bunch of processes and consciousness is our reflection on the things we haven't automated. And we're constantly automating new processes and consciousness then focused. So that's the way you want to imagine these organizations. They're constantly, when they're not broken, they are constantly routinizing stuff, but that's in order to focus on the other things. And there's some evidence you can begin to see those things going on. But I guess what I'd say is, I'd like to have this problem. I would like to have the problem of institutions that are working well enough so that there's a question of whether they're falling into routine. Yes, and then Josh.
Yeah, I just wonder to what extent there's any dialogue going on between the kind of work you're doing
that one of your bullet points, the balanced scorecard and so on. But this is, this is directly out of basically what McKinsey was doing in the 80s and into the 90s, and it's become really very, there's a big literature on it, and there's lots of organizations that have, in fact, adopted this. So there are a lot of actual potential learning that somebody interested in the public sector might be able to get from exactly how this is all worked out in at least some parts of the private sector. Is that part of the whole research project?
Yes, but the only question would be whether or not it's as worked out as you're suggesting. There's a lot of management literature that has that, you know, kind of tells you to do these things and says they're desirable. But if you ask, you know, kind of, if you look for, I mean, I follow the business school literature of this very closely, and if I've missed stuff, then I'm, you know, happy to be corrected. But I think that a lot of the business literature describes these kinds of organizations and says you should have them, but or gives little you know, two paragraph examples of, you know, kind of, you know, Cisco does this, and that's the normal format. And, you know, if you want some routine busting thing, you know, try the HP way of doing it. And they give you, you know, I just on the plane out here, I read. For reasons having to do with some stuff I'm doing with Nokia, there's a book called Agile Strategy, which is another version of these things. And if you try and find rigorous characterizations of these organizations from the point of view of, from almost any point of view in the business literature, it's very frustrating. I've spent a lot of time thinking about this is organizational sociology and why they're not hierarchies and what kind of organizations they are. I totally agree that this is what you see going on in the private sector. And I just don't think that the literature on this in the private sector. To give you an example, if you look at the literature on the very detailed literature on Japanese production systems, okay. So, but the fundamental point is yes, this is definitely happening in the private sector. There's a lot of cross-fertilization going on. And hopefully this was not a presentation aimed to contributing to that, but the project overall does indeed do that. Josh, sorry.
Okay, one last question. Keep it short.
Impossible.
You're in the wrong person.
I
No, please.
No, you got something of where there's uncertain success and maybe, you know, and costs associated with it. Those are premises. Then you do it when you're somehow forced to do it, forced by circumstance or by pressure. So you know, in the Danish case, you got a bunch of unions around, and they say, you got to do something about labor markets, things aren't working. In the child welfare case, as you said, the worst thing, there's the fact that it's unconstitutional, there's legal requirement of doing it. Mm-hmm. So the issue about whether, the issue isn't whether success might generalize. The issue is, do you expect the practice to generalize? And maybe the reason that the practice doesn't generalize is because there aren't comparable pressures in the other cases. So the prediction would be, you're not going to see this in American labor markets. These highly tailored plans for labor market success, you're not going to see them in American labor markets. Danish schools. I don't know anything about Danish schools, but there's something that's keeping this thing from happening in Danish schools. So the obvious explanation is that there's no comparable pressure to do it on the school side as there is as there was on the labor market side. It doesn't mean that it won't happen, but what would generalize it is not that it's possibly successful in all these cases, because that's the functionalist thing. But what would generalize it is that there are political pressures.
Well, I mean, just one last point, because this has come up a lot, and I think that's useful. I guess my tendency and it is to think, you know, oddly, I guess, that it's the balance of, you know, sort of costs and benefits. So the, you know, you up the costs and you up the benefits. And but it may well be that that's actually not the right way to think about it, and that it's not the balance that you need. There's some kind of level of pressure, and that probably does better at look. And I mean, it for sure does better at explaining the early discoverers without any question. And then there's a question of whether that generalizes to subsequent practice. Thank you all.
Thank you. You're all welcome to hang around a bit and have some food and drink. So partake.
It was such a pleasure to listen to you.